From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The headline out of Hong Kong earlier this year was a $150 million wedding, dowry included, with 8 days of feasting, boxes of jewels, a Mercedes, a Porsche, piles of property. That sounds like just an appetizer for Kevin Kwan's new novel, Crazy Rich Asians. It's fiction, but the phenom is not. Old money, new money, vast money is piling up in Asia. This hour on Point, Kevin Kwan takes us into the startling world of Asia's exploding wealth. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Do you know this world? Have you seen it? Where and what have you seen? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Kevin Kwan, Singapore-born, then off to America. He knows this world. His debut novel is Crazy Rich Asians. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Kevin Kwan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. It's great to have you with us. Wow, this is eye-popping. I mean, we know all the billions are out there, but you take us in a really fun way. Kirkus says Jane Austen goes to Singapore in this novel of manners. You've got us right in the middle with Chinese maid Ama saying to the children there, don't you know there are children starving in America when they don't want to eat? And you've got your American-born Chinese, or at least that's how it looks at the outset, flying into Singapore, and as she does, Kevin, saying, wow, JFK back in New York, the airport there looks like Mogadishu, Somalia, compared to this. Do you get that feeling when you fly to Asia these days, Kevin?
Very much so. I mean, Asia these days has become this really gilded land of, you know, enormously high-priced malls and shiny hotels, and it's just quite incredible to go there these days.
Let us understand your background. Who's our tour guide? It's in fiction, but you're playing off what's really going on. When did you come to the U.S.? What do you know of Singapore? How do you know this world?
I was born in Singapore, and I grew up there till I was about 12 years old, and then I moved from there to Houston, Texas. So even then, it was a huge kind of shock for me, growing up in a very cosmopolitan city like Manhattan. You know, Singapore is a small island, but it's very sort of densely populated, and moving to suburban Texas. So, you know, that was the first shock. So, you know, whenever I go back to Asia, it's just eye-popping just to see the amount of extravagance, the amounts of glitz. And I thought it'd be really fun to really talk about it in a novel.
You know, I've been looking at all the numbers here. We've heard for years about the balance of payments in trade, how it's going east, it's going to China and beyond. That has results. Yeah, I mean, now there are more billionaires in Asia than in North America. And that has happened so fast.
Just in the past decade.
Yeah. Though you remind us that it's not all new China money. There's old money in there as well, and there's some really interesting cultural meetings / clash between those two. But introduce us to the strands of wealth in Asia that you have kind of coming together around a big wedding in your novel in Singapore. What are the different layers here, Kevin?
The wedding really was the set piece that showed the clash between the different stratas of wealth that came in to commingle. You know, you had Colin Koo, who is the groom, and he comes from what would be a kind of old money family in Singapore. You know, they made their money in the past 50, 60 years.
Okay.
And, you know, his best man, who's really the protagonist of the novel, is Nick Young, who comes from a much older, you know, seriously old money fortune that was made, you know, in the 18th century.
Okay.
Maybe even earlier from, you know, from his great-great-great-grandparents bringing money from China, moving to Singapore, opening businesses back in the 18th century. So there's that world of extremely rarefied old money. There's the newer old money. And Colin is marrying a woman named Araminta Lee, who, although she was raised in Singapore primarily, was actually born in mainland China. And therein lies the snobbery towards her family. You know, her father is one of the richest billionaires from China with an original Chinese, mainland Chinese fortune. So when he throws this over-the-top $40 million lavish wedding, you know, a lot of tongues are wagging, a lot of eyebrows are raised, and a lot of fun and laughter ensues. I think it's very sort of Downton Abbey in the way you get all these, you know, snide.
Downton Abbey in Singapore. I wonder if you
agree
a little bit for us. There's a point in here where this is all being explained, or a bit of this, and especially about the mainland wealth. up against the world's one-time perceptions. Marie Helene is a sort of a European aristocrat who's visiting, and one of your Singapore characters is explaining to her what's going on. She starts inquiring here. Could you read for us, Kevin, from
Absolutely.
Crazy Rich Asians?
Would love to. Just to clarify, mm-hmm. it's actually a scene that takes place in Paris.
Oh yes.
One of the characters in the book, her name is Astrid Leong. She's in Paris. She goes there every year to check up on her shopping because she only buys couture. So she goes to Paris every April just for her, you know, her fittings.
Yep.
And she's at a very aristocratic party there and meets some people. And the minute she leaves, they start talking about her. So here we go. Laurent, tell me, how is it possible that these Chinese have been rich for generations? Marie Hélène inquired. I thought they were all penniless communists in drab little Mao uniforms not too long ago. Well, first of all, you must understand that there are two kinds of Chinese. There are the Chinese from mainland China, who made their fortunes in the past decade, like all the Russians. But then there were are the overseas Chinese. These are the ones who left China long before the communists came in many cases hundreds of years ago, and spread throughout the rest of Asia, quietly amassing great fortunes over time. If you look at all the countries in Southeast Asia, especially Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, you'll see that virtually all the commerce is controlled by the overseas Chinese, like the Lims in Indonesia, the Tans in the Philippines, the Leongs in... His wife cut in. Let me just say this. We visited Astrid's family a few years ago. You can't imagine how staggeringly rich these people are, Maria Len. The houses, the servants, the style in which they live. It makes the Arnauds look like peasants. What's more, I've been told that Astrid is a double heiress. There's an even more enormous fortune on her mother's side.
Kevin Kwan, reading from his new book, Crazy Rich Asians. I can imagine people in this country, I mean, they're rich everywhere, and they live in a over-the-top way very often everywhere. I can imagine people listening to this, this deep, super wealth that's grown up in Asia, and the lifestyle that you're describing there, which is just polished to such a super rich sheen. Some may be titillated by it. A lot may just think, oh my gosh, why do I care? Why do I want to know about this? Why should we care about the super rich of Asia, Kevin?
Because I think they're having a global influence on the rest of the world. I mean, if you look at economically what's happening, as you said, with trade, but also how they're affecting luxury commerce, for one thing. They've really, you know, the Asian consumer has become the majority consumer of luxury goods around the world. And they are literally keeping alive businesses in France, in Italy, in Germany. You know, artisans who would otherwise, I think, go out of business, you know, are finding new life.
So we should care because this new tide of super rich Asians is keeping Givenchy and Gucci in business?
To a certain extent, yes. But I think beyond that, you're seeing, you know, just the super rich and how their money is affecting the economy overall.
Yeah, Gustavo writes to us on Facebook, says, one of life's great experiences is standing out of any LV or Gucci store in Hong Kong and watching the mainlanders filling the sidewalks as they stuff their Rimowa luggage with newfound booty. I mean, you spend a lot of time in the States and New York, places of where wealth gets concentrated in this country and in Asia. What's the difference in the way it gets displayed, carried, handled here and there, Kevin?
I think Americans, for the most part, want to live more quietly. Even if they're wealthy, they don't tend to want to flaunt it as much, and they want to be as normal as possible. They want to have their private lives. They want to walk down a street. You know, I know very wealthy people in New York that take the subway, for example. But in Asia, in Hong Kong and Singapore and countries like that, for a lot of these very wealthy people, especially the new money wealthy, they live on a whole different scale. They want to be treated like modern-day royalty. They want to arrive at a restaurant in fleets of cars with security guards, you know, with waited on hand and foot. And, you know, the most unusual sight I've seen in Hong Kong, for example, is to see a young couple, maybe in their early 30s, all dressed up, bejeweled, in the middle of the day, sitting in traffic in their stretch Rolls Royce being chauffeured. And you would never find the same thing, I think, in the States. 30-something people, you know, with money, they'd rather be driving their own cars.
Yeah. What's that about? You know? Why the impulse to carry it as if royalty?
First of all, because I think it's strangely more affordable there. You know, help is cheaper. So people can, you know, the wealthy there can have armies of servants.
Okay, for the driver, but drivers, the Rolls is a Rolls,
yeah,
wherever
things like
it is.
That, yeah. But I think also there is this need to sort of, prestige is so important. Showing that you have money is kind of glorious and respected in the way that it's perhaps more frowned upon in Western societies, where people want to sort of pretend they live in a democracy and that everyone's the same.
Are other Asians looking up to that, or are they grossed out by it, sickened?
I think there's a mix. It's a mixed bag. I think that, you know, there definitely are people there who are sickened by it, who don't appreciate this flaunting and who feel very much like they are on the outside of all this. But I think there also are people who aspire to this, and they look to this. They look to these people, to these socialites. They read the fashion magazines. They look at the society magazines, and there are lots of them, I should say. You know, I mean, here we have a couple. We have Town and Country, things like that. But in Hong Kong and Singapore, there's 3, 4, 5 different types of magazines, all devoted to these lives of these fabulous, jet-setting Asian socialites.
Of course, we had Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous was no stranger to American television, so we know this dynamic. Kevin Kwan's new novel is Crazy Rich Asians. We're talking this hour about mega money and the super-rich lifestyle in the East. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with first-time novelist Kevin Kwan about mega money and the super-rich lifestyle these days in the East, and his debut novel, Crazy Rich Asians. Kevin joins us from New York City. The billions have piled up. We've seen it in the trade numbers. That money's not going nowhere. It's going into people's hands, and they're living very large, as he describes it in his fiction, very close to fact. Kevin, read a little bit more for us. There's a point in the book where most of it's around this wedding, this super wedding that's unfolding in Shanghai, but we're up in Singapore, I should say, but we're up in Shanghai at one point, and the super rich Liu Ming is showing off one of his latest acquisitions to his friend Eddie. And talk about rich. This is a very technically advanced closet at his super deluxe apartment in Shanghai. Could you read for us?
My pleasure. It was the mirror in the closet that did it. The closet in Liu Ming's brand new triplex penthouse in the Huangpu district really put Eddie over the edge. Ever since Shanghai became Asia's party capital, Liu had been spending more time here with his latest mistress, a Beijing-born starlet whose contract he had to buy over from a Chinese film company at the cost of $19 million. $1 million for every year of her life. Liu and Eddie had flown up for the day to inspect Liu's new super-luxe apartment, and they were standing in a hangar-like 2,000-square-foot closet that boasted an entire wall of floor-to-ceiling windows, Makassar ebony cupboards, and banks of mirrored closets that parted automatically to reveal cedar-lined suit racks. "It's all climate-controlled," Liu noted. "The closets on this end are maintained at 55 degrees, specifically for my Italian cashmere, houndstooth, and fur. But the shoe display cabinets are kept at 70 degrees, which is optimal for leather, and the humidity is regulated to a constant 35%, so my Berluti's and Corthets never break a sweat. You gotta treat those babies right, Hai Mai." Eddie nodded, thinking it was time to redo his own closet. "Now let me show you the piece de la resistance," Liu said, pronouncing pièce like peace. With a flourish, he glided his thumb over a mirrored panel, and its surface instantly transformed into a high-definition screen that projected the life-size image of a male model in a double-breasted suit. Above his right shoulder hovered the brand names of each item of clothing, followed by the dates and locations where the outfit had been previously worn. Liu waved a finger in front of the screen as if he were flicking a page, and the man now appeared in corduroy pants and a cable-knit sweater. "There's a camera embedded in this mirror that takes a picture of you and stores it, so you can see every single thing you've ever worn, organized by date and place. This way you'll never repeat an outfit." Eddie stared at the mirror in amazement. "Oh, I've seen that before," he said rather unconvincingly, as the envy began to course through his veins.
Kevin Kwan, reading from Crazy Rich Asians. Okay, Is it so different? Is it really? I mean, you've been out, you've been watching, you've been paying attention. You've got rich people in this country. Is it at another level in Asia now?
I think the extravagance truly is at another level because people are collecting luxury apartments, luxury houses, not just in Asia, but around the world at a breakneck pace. And they're collecting them like stamps. I mean, just look at New York where, you know, there's this new luxury tower on 57th Street where I believe four of the apartments, all over $30 million each, have been bought by mainland Chinese investors. And then there are the planes. You know, private planes are the new thing that you must have. And, you know, Boeing, I talked to them a few weeks ago for an article I was writing. You know, they're just – they can't stop making all these new customized Boeing business jets for Chinese billionaires who want planes with putting greens on them or pizza ovens or specially customized mahjong tables. It's incredible.
Planes with putting greens and pizza ovens. And in the wedding you describe in Singapore, your fictional wedding, you've got the Vienna Boys Choir brought out to sing Cirque du Soleil and ferry rides and everybody's wearing Valentino. Are you over the top in your description or is that in line with what's going on?
I think it's very much in line with what I'm going on. And you know, in fact, I started writing this book 2 years ago. And now every year I hear about even more over-the-top weddings. You know, I thought $40 million was enough to spend on a wedding. But now there's $150 million. You know, there was a wedding I heard about the other day where they had a procession of 26 exotic sports cars going down some central Chinese city. And he'd asked for these cars to be, I think, wrapped up completely in roses. So there was a team of people, you know, spending 48 hours, you know, embedding roses onto these cars.
That we've spent on products out of Asia, and it's there, and it's being spent, and it's being spent in a kind of amazing fashion sometimes. Kevin Kwan's new book is Crazy Rich Asians. Kevin, lots of callers for you. Scott in Boston. Thanks for calling, Scott. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I haven't seen the crazy money you're talking about, but I've been looking at property in the $500,000 to $700,000 range in Boston over the past year, investment property, multifamily. And I'll tell you that the majority of the people walking through the open houses are Asian, appear to be Chinese, probably the Lexus type, not the Rolls Royce type. But the realtors say they're spending cash, and that for those of us who are trying to get a mortgage and put our 20% down, it's a tough way to buy property when you're competing against a cash buyer.
Yeah, that money spills out and right into the American market, and that's not even in California, but you're saying in Boston, Scott. Kevin, how about it? We read the California numbers about all the Chinese who are looking abroad, something like a million-plus millionaires in China now, all kinds of billionaires. Are Americans going to feel this in their own markets, their real estate markets and more?
I think they're already beginning to feel it. And, you know, I can tell you probably some of those property people hunting around in Boston were looking at homes – you know, for their kids for college.
Someplace
basically
to live while they're going
dorm
to school.
Rooms, So, I think you're seeing that not just in America, but all over the world. Cash-rich Chinese are snapping up properties all over the world. It's a way to get the money out of China, in a way. And it's to create these safe havens for them.
Let me get
another
the call.
Money into real estate.
Scott, I appreciate your call. Taylor in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Taylor, you're on. What have you seen?
Hi, I'd like to share a story of a friend that I have from college that is from Shanghai, but educated in New England prep schools, and now we go to a fairly elite institution. He's graduating, and he would just spend outrageous amounts of money at school hosting parties with Grey Goose and Maker's Mark and the most expensive alcohol. He would fly with his girlfriend to France for weekends. And now is going back to Shanghai to take a job in finance, and we're all sad that we're probably not going to see him again, but you can't really blame him because he's probably going to amass, well, he's living on his dad's fortune right now, but he's probably going to amass a massive fortune of his own in Shanghai.
He may well. There have been plenty amassed there, is sort of the new go west young man is go east. It's funny, Kevin. Thanks for your call, Taylor. It's funny, there was a time when this was the American story, swanning into post-war Europe with all the money, or around the world with their steamer trunks in the gilded American age. I guess turnabout's fair play, Kevin.
I think so. But the difference I think you'll find with a lot of these Chinese people is that, you know, at the turn of the century in the U.S., there were all these playboys in Europe, just they're spending money. The Chinese, who are educated in the West, they want to go back to China and they want to make their own billions, even if they came from fortune. You know, they're as ambitious, they're as eager, they're as enterprising as anyone you'll meet.
Bob in Bloomington, Indiana. Bob, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm excited to read this book. Based on the way you guys are describing it, it sounds like the Asian version of The Great Gatsby. I wanted to know from the author, did he have those types of lofty intentions to write that, you know, Asian literary giant, or is it just that he wanted to tell the story?
Maybe more Trollope than Fitzgerald, but maybe a comedy of manners. But you tell us, Kevin, do you have that ambivalence, that deep ambivalence built into your view of this that Fitzgerald had in Gatsby?
I definitely not. I think Fitzgerald was telling a very different story. And, you know, my goal really at the end of the day is to make people laugh and to entertain them and to tell them a tale about this incredible world that's happening across, you know, the water. It's not as dystopian as I think Gatsby's ultimately is, although you see how money plays a role in affecting all these characters' lives and, you know, the repercussions they have to face, you know, with money being their god.
Money as the god. Rhett in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Rhett, you're on the air. What do you think, Rhett?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hello to your guest. My initial reaction when I heard the opening comments here was nauseating. I felt nauseous, and I don't know whether that's coming from jealousy, envy, as you mentioned before. I don't think so. I am a man, a family man, who has struggled long and hard to provide the minimum for my growing family, and have had to do with little, and kind of oriented my children not to expect too much from me, because, you know, they're aware of the wealth and the things, the nice flashy things.
Yep.
But, you know, I do all I can to provide for them the fundamental stuff. So to hear the chuckling about it and, you know, the lightheartedness, and to hear your guest say that he wants to make people laugh as they read, it's far from laughable to many, many, many millions, hundreds of millions on the face of the earth who are doing with much, much less than I am and many others. I consider myself fortunate compared to many, but I just don't see where this is a laughable matter. And for people, Asians, Africans, Americans, Brits, I don't care who they are, with this kind of wealth, and to not squander it, but to amuse themselves and try to impress others, I have a problem with that. In the face of so much pain that we all live among.
Hey, Red, I'll raise that with Kevin, and of course, in Asia, there are plenty of people in deep poverty as well. So, you know, that perspective works right around the world. But in fairness, in the West, there were plenty of, you know, the comedy of manners had a pretty good workout talking about the silly excesses of Europeans and Americans in their day as well. I mean, it's not as if this is just Asia that has this phenom of the super rich or people in literature who will write and laugh about them, Rhett.
Oh, that's fine. Now, I wasn't, as I said, I don't care if they're Asians, Americans, Africans, or who it is that's laughing and, you know, making light of it. That's not the point. The point is, you know, in the face of so much need among so many, that so few can, you know, live this way, and I guess live with themselves. It's just, you know, that's my comment, and I'll listen off. Off the phone now. Turn the radio up. Thanks.
Rhett, I appreciate your call very much. Kevin, what are you thinking as you hear that complaint from Rhett?
I really hear Rhett, and I really understand Rhett, and I can completely empathize what he says. And I should point out that in my book, you know, there are characters who are as appalled as he is by the flagrant displays of wealth, by the money that's being spent. You know, Rachel, the heroine of the book, she's an American-born Chinese, mm-hmm. comes from a very hardworking family background, you know, worked her way up, became a successful professor, and she's taken into this world and introduced to this world of Asian wealth, and she's absolutely bewildered and appalled and at the same time strangely fascinated by this world. So, you know, it's not all just rah-rah celebration and glitz and glamour. You know, this is a very multi-layered, hopefully sensitive look at this world of wealth from very different perspectives. I know we've been talking about the glitz for a while, mm-hmm. but along with the glitz, you'll see the rich aren't necessarily the happiest people in the world either. And they have their problems. And there ensues, I think, the entertainment of this book.
I mean, what about the reaction? I know there have been waves in China, for example, at different points of the kind of revulsion that Rhett's describing there. There was this famous catfight not long ago between Chinese socialites who were bragging online about their wealth. One who showed up, put a photo up on the Chinese, on Weibo, the Chinese Twitter, of her sitting with something like $8 million worth of chips. I think it was in a Singapore casino. And then the guys coming back and putting photographs of their bank accounts with millions and billions in those accounts up again, photos and a kickback, revulsion within China over that.
It's one of these stories that made me want to write this book. I just felt that you needed to reveal this the world, and people can take from it what they want, and judgment what they want. But there have been repercussions. You see in China, for example, politicians who are used to spending millions of dollars on parties every night, they're suddenly becoming much more low profile because the masses are noticing, and quite a few of them are not happy with how they have so little. And these politicians who they feel are corrupt have so much.
What about the nuance of interaction here between money outside China, the overseas Chinese that you read about, and the new mainland wealth? Presumably some of that overseas Chinese money is older because they weren't under a Maoist system in most of the 20th century like China was. Now here come the new billions from the Chinese factory owners and much more. How are they perceived, let's say, the Chinese community in Singapore?
I think the Chinese old money in Singapore are just sort of very, very bewildered by all this new money coming in, because it's also affecting property prices in Singapore. The mainland Chinese are coming in with their golf bags stuffed with cash to buy up properties too. And people are just as bewildered as we are in the West there. These are families like in my book, Nick's family, has been wealthy for very, very many generations. And their whole thing is thrift, not showing off, not ever telling people how much money they have. And so when they see this woman come in spending $40 million on her wedding, they are completely, completely appalled.
They react
to it in very humorous ways, and hopefully they'll make people laugh when they read the book.
But, appalled, but also with sort of the eye of wealth saying, hey, maybe we can get a piece of that or marry some of that into our wealth line.
Exactly. Or, they have businesses that are now doing business with mainland China, so they're benefiting as well. So you're seeing all these countries in Southeast Asia that are sort of part of this wealth effect. They are benefiting in some ways, but in other ways, they're feeling the bite of property prices going up, of the cost of living going up in countries like Singapore and Hong Kong, which make it harder for the middle classes.
If you think you feel it in the States, think about those front row seats. Growing trend in the world of Asian popular music, Cantonese pop singers recording albums in Mandarin in order to tap into that growing market on mainland China. Here's Bye Bye off of Denise Ho's new Mandarin album, Coexistence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with first-time novelist Kevin Kwan, Singapore-born, raised after 12 in the USA, talking about mega money and the super-rich lifestyle these days in rich parts of the East, and his debut novel, Crazy Rich Asians. You can read an excerpt at our website. Big get-together around a super-rich wedding in Singapore in his story, and all the kind of shenanigans and displays of wealth and over-the-topness that goes with that. Of course, that wasn't born in Asia, but it's pretty eye-popping the way he describes it in fiction and in reality these days. Kevin Kwan joins us from New York City, and we've got Maeve calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. What do you think, Maeve? Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Kevin. I'm glad to read this book. I love stuff like this. I was lucky. I was in Singapore back in the 80s. I worked with an airline. It wasn't as if I could afford to fly all over the world. But
okay.
We loved Singapore. We loved to go into Singapore. But we did pick up on something. We got spend about a week there every time we flew in. And we picked up on a sort of a very quiet racism, if you like. The local people sort of resented Chinese because they were the merchants, they were involved in the banks, they were involved in money loan lending, hotels, of course, owned by. So there was that sort of mega rich but not showy. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I suppose that's what your guest is calling old money.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lot of money. And but I feel that, you know, well, also there was whispers. That's true. In the past, they said that a lot of their money was made. This is the local Singaporeans now saying that a lot of the money was made by opium dens back in the 1700s, that there was drug money. There was whispers about, you know, the Chinese.
Yeah, of course, that was the old days. They don't need drug money anymore when you've got factories and shipping lines and everything else. But Maeve, if I may, let me ask Kevin about this issue of, I mean, Maeve thought she felt a quiet racism. Of course, this is not a secret in Singapore. There's been plenty of tension, Singapore, Malaysia, between Chinese and native Malays, Bumiputra and all the rest. I'm sure you know that, Kevin. But what about those tensions? And even, I don't know, ethnocentrism or even racism?
I think we could have a whole conversation for an hour about this. Mm-hmm. there are so many levels of subtle racism and snobbery that exist in Asia, and especially in Singapore, in a culture where, you know, there are four different types of races living together.
Chinese and South
Chinese,
Asians,
Indians, Malays, European expats. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, there's bound to be a little bit of, you know, sort of friction, but I think the miracle of Singapore, in a way, is that, generally speaking, these people live in complete harmony, and, you know, they mix very freely. You know, I had Malay friends, Indian friends growing up,
mm-hmm.
and it's really kind of amazing how multicultural this country is, and how, with so many people of different races, different religions, and different belief systems living on a tiny island. You know, 5 million.
Yep.
But can basically all get along.
They do pull it off. Though within the super rich Chinese sector that you're really describing here, you portray a hyper-attuned population here when it comes to status and standing. How does that work? And what about your protagonist, Rachel Chu, the Chinese-American young woman who comes over? She doesn't really know that her boyfriend is a member of such a super rich family. What's the world she finds there in terms of status, and how is she received as a Chinese American?
You know, I think she's received very snobbishly because, you know, in the world that Nick comes from, this very rarefied community of very private, wealthy families, they really intermarry amongst themselves, and they want to keep it all in the family in a way. And then Nick's mother wanted him to marry someone that comes from the right sort of family, the right sort of crowd.
Which would be another rich Chinese family.
Exactly. Another rich Chinese family from Singapore, you know, preferably that would be and a family that she knows, mm-hmm. and a family that she can put in her social universe and say, oh, these are the people. We know this family going back three generations. They're safe. Whereas Rachel is a complete interloper coming from America. She's American educated. She's got these modern progressive ideas and she doesn't ascribe to this world. She doesn't understand it. She doesn't really care. And I think that's what causes all the confusion between the way her families clash with one another.
Help is cheap, as you more or less put it in this book. And you've got scenes where she's assigned, I think it's Rachel, is assigned a maid when she comes into the family compound, a maid who's going to do things that even in the United States, this is not things a maid, you know, brush your hair, draw your bath, make sure the shower's on at just the right temperature, you know, just sort of way
keep
beyond.
Your clothes well folded at all times.
I mean, it's a kind of, it almost seems like Arabian Nights or something quality. Is that real or is that just you taking us over the top?
It truly, truly is. Let me tell you a story. When I was in Hong Kong a few years ago, I landed in Hong Kong and was, you know, I was told by my host that I would be met by someone. And I didn't realize that someone would be four Filipino maids had come to receive me at the airport when I arrived. And I have no idea why my host thought they needed, you know, four women to help me with one backpack. And then we get to the house and, you know, they asked me, it was early morning. My hosts were not in, they were already at work. And I was asked what I wanted for breakfast, and I said, "Oh, I don't care anything, you know." And I wish I hadn't said that in hindsight, because anything to them
meant
everything.
Everything. Right.
So they literally made me everything. You know, I took a shower, came out of the shower, and apparently they had gone frantic. All the maids, they'd run out to the grocery store, and they made me. They had French toast, pancakes, they had Chinese porridge, they had, you know, fish. I mean, I felt so bad and so embarrassed, but this is the kind of lifestyle these people are used to. And living in New York, you know, living a very normal life that I do, it's still startling for me.
Very particular lifestyle.
Whenever I travel and come into.
Yeah, they're super rich, but they're also living super rich next door to populations in China and elsewhere in Asia that in some cases are still super poor, which makes that kind of hands-on help affordable and available. Linda in Nashville, Tennessee is calling. Hi, Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to share my latest guilty pleasure, which in the last 6 months has been almost becoming addicted to Korean comedies on TV.
Why? How? What's? I don't know them.
I know, and you have to read the, you know, the subtitles, and I know a lot of words now in Korean.
Okay.
Mainly, I sit here, and after watching so many, it's exactly what your guest is talking about. There's always, these are like Cary Grant slapstick comedies, romantic comedies. Every show has a very rich person and a very poor person. Of course, they do become a couple in the end, but the houses, the apartments, I'm almost talking to myself now. Now when they come on, I say, oh, yeah, sure. You know, they move their hand over and this giant wall opens and the men have all their high-dollar expensive watches in a row. And when you read, I've done a little bit of reading on things as I watch them, they spend... We talk about special effects in this country in movies, but they spent like over $20,000 buying shoes for one of the characters, one of the women characters.
Now, you can watch Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous in America. Does it make you feel like the poor church mouse, Linda?
Pardon?
Does it make you feel like the poor church mouse looking, you know, with your nose pressed against the window?
I sit there and I say, I want to go to Seoul. I mean, does everybody have a house shaped like this? And everyone has, the apartments are unbelievable. Everyone wears designer clothes.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Not everybody lives that way. But, Kevin, you tell the story about what's up and what's down. I mean, Singapore, pretty small and one of the highest standards of living in the world, of course. Get into bigger countries, Korea, or the biggest country, China. And, of course, you have the whole spectrum and plenty of very poor.
Absolutely. And, you know, I also want to say that those Korean dramas are as popular in Singapore and Hong Kong as they are for this calling in person. I'm glad she's enjoying that.
Linda's hooked. Brian in New Haven, Connecticut. Brian, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I work in private boarding schools in New England. I've worked in a number of them, and it's pretty fascinating. It has been to watch over the last 15 years which countries the economy is doing well, because you'll see an influx of that country's students. So originally it was Japan, then it was Thailand, then it was Korea, and now it's mainly China. And 5 years ago, the school where I worked, there wasn't a single mainland Chinese student, maybe one or two, but it was old money.
Yeah.
Now, there are staggering numbers of mainland Chinese students, and the type of student, they're always very academically very strong, but the way they spend money is much different. You know, weekend trips become these spending sprees. I'm talking $6,000-$10,000 coming back with designer shoes and clothes and watches, and whereas before I never saw that that type of money wasn't spent, but the new money, it is eye popping. You know, the amount that, you know, designer everything.
But Brian, your observation would flow right into Kevin Kwan's book. It sounds like a page right out of it. And no doubt, you're right. Different generations bring in from whatever countries around the world are doing particularly well. I appreciate your call, Brian. Kevin Zinya writes to us online. She says, why should we care about these super rich Asians? For one thing, she says, they're keeping our universities afloat. And it sounds like private boarding schools as well, Kevin.
And And car dealerships, I think, too, are benefiting from that.
Yeah.
So it's there's a trickle down there of how they're spending their money and how it's how it's affecting everyone.
Lots of global travel here. I mean, one thing you can't say about the people that you're describing is that they're insular. They're incredibly, as you describe them, cosmopolitan.
Extremely so. I mean, the new Asian wealth is a very mobile, highly jet-set crowd, and they, you know, they want to spend their money overseas. They want to experience the world in as much as it's possible. So, you know, no matter where you go, New York, London, Paris, you're seeing more and more of this presence of this Chinese money come in, of people shopping along the Champs-Élysées, of people in Knightsbridge in London, and they're all buying up the towns. And I think the shopkeepers are pretty happy about it.
Yes, there is a section of the airplane and a section of the town that's going to be supported by that kind of money. Let's go to Jeff in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Jeff, what do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess there's a couple different conversations here. I have no problem, you know, attacking gross opulence or, you know, hyper displays of wealth, but it's kind of unfair, I suppose, to critique the current display of the Asian new money or Asian old money when you don't even have to go back 100 years in this country to the industrial age to see, you know, like the Rockefellers or the J.P. Morgans or the MacArthurs, where they amassed massive amounts of money and had no problem displaying that.
Not to mention plenty of super rich Americans right now, Jeff.
Exactly, yeah. And they, you know, now as your guest was saying, it's not as socially acceptable to display that, and I suppose those super wealthy Asians are, you know, going towards that trend of not displaying it nearly as much. But yeah, I mean, we're not. It's kind of like the pot calling the kettle black in this instance, in my opinion.
Definitely, rich Americans have been there with their steamer trunks off around the world. And point taken. If I'm gonna get one more right on top of that, Angelo. Thank you, Jeff. Angelo in Hamden, Connecticut. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I have a question. Yeah. Do the Asian super rich have a sense of social obligation? At least in the United States, we've seen very wealthy families giving money to foundations, universities, cancer research, and so forth. Are the Asian super rich just counting their designer shoes and watches? I think it's important for wealthy people to have a sense of social obligation. Otherwise, I think that, you know, without that sense of obligation, you have significant negative consequences that could occur.
Recipe for trouble. What about it, Kevin? What do you see?
I think that's a really, really great point. I think what you're seeing in Asia now is there is a new social consciousness, and you are seeing a whole new wave of philanthropy that you never saw before. I think traditional Asian culture has all been about preserving family wealth as much as possible, being as secretive about it, and you know, it was all about having the money to pass on to future generations. And I think you're seeing all these newly minted billionaires, and even a lot of old money families who have become much more generous, much more charitable. You see so many more foundations being set up, so many more charities being supported by this, you know, incredible wave of money. So I think there is some good in that sense coming out of that.
You're generous in that observation. In your book, your American Chinese character, Rachel Chu, toward the end says, I'm sorry, but I've had enough. I've had enough of being around all these crazy rich Asians, all these people whose lives revolve around making money, spending money, flaunting money, comparing money, hiding money, controlling others with money, ruining their lives over money. As our Oklahoma caller says, you could make that complaint pretty much anywhere in the world, but she makes it loud and clear there in her sojourn to the super rich levels of Asia you described, Kevin.
Well, you know, that's what I found in the commonalities of how money affects people, no matter where they live. You know, a lot of money comes with a lot of consequences. And that's what I wanted to explore in this book and hopefully tell a story that everyone could relate to and everyone could sort of appreciate in a light and fun way.
You know, we've got the news just in the last couple of days of Rupert Murdoch's latest wife, Wendy Deng Murdoch, who was born Deng Wengei, which means cultural revolution in Chinese. Amazing. But they're getting divorced. She was born in China, of course, and came into Rupert Murdoch's world. I mean, talk about super rich in the West. There's Murdoch with his many billions. How do you think somebody like Wendy Deng will be seen in the hierarchy of wealthy Chinese that you describe in Crazy Rich Asians, Kevin?
I think she's very well respected as someone that, you know, worked hard and got a great education and, you know,
snagged a billionaire.
Snagged a billionaire, but, you know, she's also gone into movie producing now and has, you know, produced a great movie, and we'll see.
You quote, we shall see.
You quote Napoleon Bonaparte in the book, "Let China sleep," Napoleon said, "for when she awakens, she will shake the world." Is this part of that shake? Where's it going to take us, Kevin?
Your guess is as good as mine. I think we're in this new era of Asian money, and it's going to have repercussions around the world in crazy, crazy ways.
Are your Asian readers enjoying this or saying, give us a break, Kevin Kwan?
I think for the most part, everyone I've talked to has really, really enjoyed the book. They've really laughed a lot. I mean, this, as I say from the very beginning, this is very much a satire. It's an over-the-top comedy looking at this world. You know, one reviewer compared my book very much to an English manor house novel, and I consider that the highest compliment. It's really about a family. It's about relationships. It's about a romance that takes place in Asia. The setting is amongst all these wealthy, crazy Asians, but, you know, love is the same anywhere you go.
And off Kevin Kwan goes with Crazy Rich Asians, Downton Abbey of the East, plus, I would say, a little turbocharged on top of all those billions, a comedy of manners. Kevin Kwan, you're generous with your time and thoughts today. We're grateful to you for joining us. Congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's been great fun.
Kevin Kwan, author of Crazy Rich Asians. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast there, onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.